This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Now I'd like to welcome to the stage Dr. Bruce Moore. Bruce has a life in dictionaries. And so my first question to Bruce is, how do you have a life in dictionaries?
Well, actually, it was a very late life in dictionaries. I spent most of my life being a medievalist, teaching Old English and Middle English, and I thought that would, you know, that's how I might end. But there was a chance in the early 90s it came about, or the late 80s. I ended up teaching Old and Middle English in the English department at the Royal Military College Duntroon, here in Canberra, teaching Army cadets Old English, Middle English, just so they need to know. And
just in case we go to war with Yorkshire, I suppose, yeah.
Just in case they needed to be literate and things of that kind. And indeed, when I think back of it, I think a lot of you would have seen David Kilcullen in the last few years talking about Australian Defence, and he was one of our great Old English students and Middle English students at Duntroon. But it was in the middle of the 80s when the Royal Military College Duntroon was about to be turned into the Australian Defence Force Academy. We had a whole lot of young chaps, and they're all 18, 19 year olds, who clearly had a special language of their own. They're all army, and their institution was going to be changed. And what we thought was it'd be interesting to have a look at the kind of language that a group of 18, 90-year-old army males used in 1985 or so, and see what happened when you changed the institution, had the three defence forces there and had women there. You know, would the language change? And so a detailed survey was done. And as I look around the room, I do see Pauline Bryant here, who in fact did draw up the original survey. And the students were surveyed about their language, and they filled in forms about their language, and nothing was done with this. So it was in the late 1980s that I had a look at this and thought, oh, there's possibilities here. I looked at the results, and as a result of that, I did produce a dictionary, or what I called in a fairly arty-farty kind of way, a lexicon of cadet language at the Royal Military College Duntroon. I almost got shot when it was published, or when the first copy appeared on the desk of the then commandant at Duntroon. And there are all sorts of problems about its publication, but that got me interested in the business of dictionaries, the possibility of a career change. It was then that I was offered the chance to do a dictionary, the Australian Pocket Oxford Dictionary, and then I thought, you know, here's a chance to change. And so I shifted in the early 90s from medieval studies into dictionaries, which sort of, you know, that's one way that you get into dictionary making. And indeed, the track from teaching in medieval studies, the history of the English language, into dictionary making and lexicography is quite an established one. The other sorts of theories about how you get into this business, one that's going round, it's been going round for about the last 20 years, is that many lexicographers are in fact left-handed. And that Dr. Johnson was left-handed, and when we looked around, many of the lexicographers in the world at the moment, John Simpson at Oxford, then Catherine Barber in Canada. I was looking at lunch, Sue, but I didn't quite work out which hand you were using. But so left-handedness sort of does seem to be one sort of possible way of getting into lexicography. The other is to come from Wellington. That many of the present lexicographers around the world, in fact, come from Wellington. Bill Ramson, who did the Australian National Dictionary, George Turner, that many of you would know from Adelaide, did a number of Australian dictionaries. Robert Birchfield, who was the previous editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, he was from Wellington. Eric Partridge sort of gets in. He at least came from New Zealand. He went to Queensland. And then again, and then he went to Britain and worked. And worked. So that if you're left-handed, if you come from Wellington, and possibly if you're gay, that helps.
If you're left-handed and come from Wellington at the moment, you might be playing cricket for New Zealand this very instant.
Yeah. It's a good party starter.
To take up David Malouf's point then, did you start to think in Middle English? Because he suggests that we think in English and we think in French and we think in German.
I think it is true that what he was saying about the language, I mean, I know Old English, for example, is a language that is very much like modern German. So when David, in fact, now that he's gone, was complaining about the fact that the German has tended to compound words rather than borrow words from other languages, this indeed was the basic feature of Old English. Old English was a compounding language, just like modern German. What happened to English, and I think everybody's been saying this today, that it lost that sort of compounding ability and started borrowing words from everywhere. I like to think of English as being, you know, it was the winner because it was the most promiscuous language of all the language. It'll take anything. And that's I think one of the reasons for its strength. So that English has become not like Anglo-Saxon. It's changed completely, and it's lost its case system and so on. And of course, it's lost the kind of worldview that was embodied in that compounding language. I think that's the other thing that people have been saying today, that what's true of all that all languages do carry, I think, some kind of history of both the culture and its speakers, and certainly what David was saying about English, I think, is true of that.
So what happened when English came to Australia? What if you're talking about culture and history and its embodiment through the language, what happened to English?
I like to divide it into two areas, and I think it's quite important to do this. I think you really, they come together later, but to understand what happened to Australian English, I think you really do have to separate off what happened to the accent and what happened in the creation of Australian words. Now, we haven't talked a lot about accent here. It strikes me as interesting that the first thing about Australian English that was really established was, in fact, the accent. And the accent was created by getting rid of all those features of all the Englishes that were being spoken in Sydney. You know, 100 or so different dialects being spoken, many with extremely, you know, strong, distinctive dialect markers, you know, that you could hear the Scots, you could hear the Irish, and so on. That we now know that a colonial or a settler dialect is created by getting rid of all those strong dialectal features. And if you think about, you know, when people come to Australia, either from America, Britain, and so on, when they come here, we can hear that they might modify their accents a little bit, but they don't much. You know, you can have an 80-year-old person who's been, you know, came from Scotland when he was 20, and he's still got a strong Scots accent. That is, the people who came here first, all the first settlers, the convicts, and so on, they might have changed their accent a little bit, but not very much at all. What we now know, and we know this because of the evidence that's now come from New Zealand. What was fascinating in New Zealand in the 1940s during the war, when the New Zealand Army didn't seem to have much to do with its time, it went around recording people and made a lot of significant historical recordings of people who'd been born in New Zealand between 1850 and 1900. So what we had for the first time, and we've been making guesses about how languages are formed, you know, how settler languages are formed. And the common metaphor were things like cakes, you know, like fruitcakes. You know, bung a bit of Lancashire in, bung a bit of Irish in, you know, bung a bit of Scots, bung a bit of Devonish in, and bung them all in, you get much. You probably end up with a fruitcake, you know. And the fruitcake in Sydney is a bit like the one in Perth, and a bit like the one in Melbourne. It sort of looks like a fruitcake. And that was the common metaphor. But now we know when people started looking or rehearing these recordings that were made in the 1940s of people, the children of the first settlers in New Zealand, right? These are the first generation of children. And for the first time we had recorded, we could hear what these people sounded like. And what was extraordinary was that brothers and sisters had different accents. That people who went to the same school together all had slightly different accents. They didn't have the accents of their parents. What the first generation of kids had done was to listen and pick up bits and pieces from all over the place. They didn't pick really strong dialect markers. You know, they weren't silly enough, you know, to pick up a really strong element of a Scots accent. They all went roughly for sort of middle of the road, and they turned out to be southern English dialect features. But they all sound a bit different. All the kids of the first generation all sound a bit different. So we can now then shift that to Sydney, and probably the same thing was going on there. What happens when they looked at these recordings, the kids of the next generation all sound the same, right? They've all got the same accent. And so there, with that next generation, school kids, you know, operating as all school kids do, right? They now level off the accent and they all make sure that they all speak in the same way. What's interesting there, therefore, is that we can predict that the Australian accent should have been established by the 1830s. And all our historical records say it was. Every record that we had have people from overseas commenting on the language of the children born in the colony, and all the records say that the language is remarkably pure. The children born in the colony speak a remarkably pure form of English. What they mean is they don't sound like a Scotsman, they don't sound like an Irishman, they don't sound like a Cornishman, and they certainly don't come from Kent. And so on. And so what they mean is that all of those strong dialectal features have disappeared, and now we have what we regard as the Australian accent. So that in some ways sort of dialect stuff was highly taboo at this stage. And so the accent gets developed, I think, between, you know, 1790 and into the 1830s. So the accent's established. I think what's important when you look at the records once again is that when we think of Australian words, the really important Australian words, they do not appear at that early stage. All of the important Australian words, the words that carry Australian meaning, Australian identity, Australian values, are all a product of the 1860 and onwards period. And interestingly, lots of them are borrowed from English dialects. Right? And that's the sort of paradox. There's about 170, 180 words that we've taken from British dialects. Words like dinkum, words like to dob someone in, words like skiting, and so on. Lots of important Australian words all came in the second half, I think, of the 19th century when the accent had been established, dialect was no longer an issue. We could now borrow words, and we borrowed them from the new migrants. And the words we borrowed came from Northern England and Scotland.
So is dinkum, where's that from, dinkum?
Dinkum's from Lincolnshire. It's one of the ones that we now know, in spite of the fact if you sort of Google dinkum in, and you'll find, oh yes, this is one of the words Australian borrowed from the Chinese during the gold rushes, when we were all so, you know, receptive and friendly and invited them across for cups of tea and things like that. That, and they said, oh, you know, you're a real dinkum blokes, aren't you? Supposedly means dinkum top gold. Right? Real gold. I mean, that's the standard story. But, I mean, we didn't borrow any words from Chinese. And one of the interesting things, and to think, again, what people have been saying this morning, one of the interesting things about Australian English, as distinct from English, is just how resistant, isn't it, that Australian English has been to borrowing any words from any language other than an English. We've borrowed from British dialects. We're quite happy to borrow from American English, whinge for 10 years and then forget that we took them. But If you think of all the other migrant groups that have come to Australia speaking other languages, I always put out the challenge, can anyone think of one word that Australian English has borrowed from a language other than English? No, from Italian, from Greek?
There are quite a number of German words.
Possibly for someone from South Australia. We'll say perhaps there's a few German words lurking around, and sure, if we're around on the gold fields in the 1850s and, you dug your hole and there was no bloody gold there and you say, this is a scheisse, this is just shit. But we took it from the Germans via British slang. A lot of our German words come in via London slang, just as a lot of Yiddish words in Australian English. I cannot believe. Can any of you think of a social situation in which Australia could have borrowed Yiddish words from Yiddish-speaking people? So, we now know that cobber comes from Yiddish, right? And it doesn't come, again, from Lincolnshire. It doesn't come from Lincolnshire, as people thought it. But we're now quite sure that it's from Yiddish kava. But can we work out how it got into Australian English? And we're not sure. The other famous one is Kleiner. Right? Anyone who knows their C.J. Dennis will know the opening stanzas of The Sentimental Bloke. The girlfriend is described as my Kleiner. C-L-I-N-E-R, but sometimes spelt with a K, right? And it is from German, Kleiner, little. Now, the earliest records of that say, there are all these wonderful Germans in South Australia. This is before the First World War. and our first record of this, of them saying this, is in 1912. And all those wonderful Germans, and we've taken, we love them all, and we've taken some words like Kleiner for a girlfriend from them. So that's one, and there are probably a few other in South Metfust. Australia. But we only kept it for another 20 years, right? So perhaps the German settlement was certainly one possible situation where we got some words, and they're probably more around in South Australia than in other parts. But you think of, Italian migrants, Greek migrants, all the Asian migrants and so on, I think it's very difficult to think of a word we've borrowed. And that's odd, isn't it? Because most other Englishes, as I said before, English itself has been absolutely promiscuous. Grab any word that's passing by. And American English has been reasonably receptive to taking in words from migrant language. And so has Canadian. And so has Canadian English. But I find it odd that Australian English hasn't. Sorry? Who?
Port. Oh, sorry?
Port
is
in the drink.
Oh. Portmanteau.
Okay, port, yeah, well, sure, I mean, and to go back to David, they all come from Latin too. But it comes into Australian English via portmanteau. And so it's with lots of English words, they came into English via French. But I'm talking about words that came directly into Australian English. And I just think it's extraordinary, when we think of ourselves and how wonderful we really are and how we love our migrants. And so it just is odd that it's difficult. Pauline.
I need to
Sorry.
You're right. No, go for it. Go for it.
I did a survey as part of my regional studies in South Australia, looking for borrowed Cornish or German words into English, and found absolutely nothing except one old Cornish chap who could remember that the guttering around the house was called the launder, but he said nobody uses it anymore. Apart from that, it's really only the names of foods.
Yeah, foods and certain place names. I mean, in South Australia, the Cornish word for a mine, W-E-A-L-H, wear, is used around Munta and places like that. When we look at our record, sure, we've got about 10 words that came from Cornish, but they're mainly Cornish English words. rather than actual Cornish words. And one good example, of course, we know, for example, that fossick, to fossick, first of all, for gold, and then fossick round, you know, trying to get, I hope I did, two socks that match in the draw. But I mean, that came into Australian English in the 1850s from Cornish English. It's not a Cornish word, but it came in via Cornish English. So that, as I say, from 1850 onwards, lots of words come in from dialect, but they're all, as it were, English dialect words. I don't believe, anyway, that any Gaelic words, for example, came in, but some would disagree.
My name's Jane. There are quite a number of, well, to my experience anyway, Malay words have been used for a long time in our language here and in New Zealand too. And I'd like to know your opinion. Do those words, for example, kaput, khaki and many others, did they come in via English colonialism, or did they come in to Australia more recently via the Australian army involved in the communist emergency in Malaya?
All of those that you mentioned come through colonial experience into English and therefore into Australian English. When we sort of look at the sort of experience in the north, I've been, for example, having another look recently at the word plonk. Now, most of us, I think, believe, and we're all been sort of trained to believe, that plonk is one of those Australian words that, you know, that Australian soldiers picked up in France during the First World War, and it's a corruption of Van Blanc. And all these Aussie soldiers were going around drinking white wine, yeah. and saying, you know, oh,
singing,
you know,
opera.
Plonk to you. And I think most dictionaries believe that sort of plonk came from French. The problem with it is that there are no records of it. There's one brief record of it in a sort of about 1933. All of our words that were borrowed or created during the First World War do appear in the writings, the newspapers and so on of the troops. That's why it's such a rich period for Australian English. Plonk comes in much later and does in fact become popular during the Second World War. And then the records sort of start to be associated with Malaya and places like that. We haven't found a source, but some Australian words were certainly created by the troops up there, but we haven't found where they came from. My other example, I think, if anybody's got an answer, I'd be interested, is our Australian word donga for a temporary accommodation, you know, those sort of buildings. Most people have believed the story that it comes from South Africa. Then the story goes, the Boer War, a word in Afrikaans for a steep ravine, right, was donga. It came to Australia and was used for various areas out near Woomera, depressions in the ground, which were called dongas. And then some of you will know, won't you, the word donga for going out in the donga, out into the bush, or if it's really thick bush, out into the donga donga. And then another word that suddenly seems to be everywhere, this other donga, which is the temporary accommodation, which seems to be in its early records associated with New Guinea, with houses in the Second World War, but we haven't been able to track down, you know, if it does come from a New Guinea language. So once again, it's, you know, it's desperately looking for them.
What about the one associated with the dead
dingo? Different donga answer. Sorry. As in dryers. Yes. We'll get to comparisons in a minute. I want to ask about the shit Carter's had, actually.
Max Richardson first, if that's all right. Two things. One is that the word Kleiner, my grandmother used to talk about, she's in about talking about a girlfriend. She's someone who is inclined to you. You're incliner. And I'm quite sure that's probably where it came from. I'm not sure about that, because once you talk linguistics, you're going to open up this big can of worms.
I think the clear argument against it would be the early spellings.
Right? Yeah, the K.
The early spellings with the K and the EI. That is, the early records are much closer to the German. It's a little bit like, you know, it's the same kind of evidence that you get with the old word drac.
And you're getting that with Mathilde for waltzing Matilda.
Wow. And I don't think that's
the other one is, I'm wondering whether a lot of the French words came as the word love does in tennis. When the tennis say love, it's zero.
Yep.
Portmanteau would have been an upper... They're all upper-class British-English words that the upper-class used to speak French to keep the people in their place.
Yeah.
And, pas devant les enfants, pas devant les domestiques, and so on. And it was done with a very rich upper-class received pronunciation. And that's where you're looking at a lot of French words particularly, because it was the language of sans nobilité, snobbery, I think.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are two things there. If you think about English in general, there's the two movements. I mean, sort of one's the Norman French, which I think is quite different from what you're saying there. And that's sort of 12th century to 13th century. But 14th, 15th century is what you're saying about French as the language of culture. And that's a sort of different influx. But going sort of forward, once, as I'm not allowed to say, going forwards to the...
I think that's appropriate use of going forwards, actually.
To the First World War. I mean, what's interesting when we look back at the letters, the newspapers and so on of soldiers who are in either the First World War or the Second World War, it's interesting that they all talk about the new language, you know. We've got all these wonderful new terms with you calling this and this that. And isn't it great when we get back to Australia, you know, we're going to bring all these words in, and isn't Australian English going to be enriched? And, of course, as soon as the war's finished and they're back here, they're dead. And it's pretty rare for those words that are created within a country that's speaking another language for them then to be transferred back to Australia.
A lot of them linger on in the army.
Yes, true.
Die.
Yes. Di Johnson, swear words. Australians are terribly good at them and inventing them, but parents are very concerned about them and don't want their children to use them. What, in your terms, is a swear word, and what sort of judgments do you make about what is an acceptable word to put in your dictionaries?
Whenever we do one of the junior dictionaries, and those words are not there, and they're always marketing decisions. Huh? Unless you're doing a very big dictionary like the OED, which doesn't have to worry about money, most decisions about the words that go into dictionaries have a lot to do with marketing. So that a number of the dictionaries that we produce say that are geared at kids from 15 downwards, the publisher is very likely to say that there are three words at least that can't go into this dictionary.
What are they?
You go and ask a 10-year-old.
Collingwood?
but yes, and so it... It is a worry, you know, when I go and talk to school kids, and I think, oh, God, who is this wanker? You know, he produces dictionaries that don't have the words that we use in them. You know,
he's from Wellington.
Them, you know,
he's left-handed.
So that is an issue there. And I think in dictionaries at that level, you really do need to look carefully at levels of offence, not just swear words, but offensive words. Racist words and so on. Now, I mean, I don't think that putting them into a dictionary gives them validity, but some people do, and some schools do, and so on. So that there certainly are decisions to be made there. With the larger dictionaries, though, that are geared for adults like us, I think it's the task of the dictionary maker to give a complete record, you know, of the spoken language, so that if you start with a dictionary the size of the Oxford English Dictionary, everything's in. right? Even though they left out three in there. And the third one, I can say this, and the third one was condom. But that's not the one we leave out of the primary school dictionary. We put that one in.
Two quick questions.
Digby Harbour. There's a word I came across in the Northern Territory that I heard the kids say it often enough, if you didn't agree with someone, you told them that they were gammoning. Yep. Also in South Australia, there's a couple of words when I was a kid, like Ronnie's and Brinnie's and Treadley's, when you don't hear them out here in the East.
Okay, the first one, Yonnies and Brinnie's and so on. These sort of, you know, sort of belong. I mean, I knew Yonnies being a good Geelong boy, and that was certainly a Victorian word. And there are Ronnies and Brinnies and so on. There seems to be these regional variants across Australia. A lot of these regional variants, I think, you know, do seem to be sort of and Treadley for the bike. You know, that I think that was used pretty widely, but is now just slightly old-fashioned. Some words certainly do die. And some sort of regional words do die out. I mean, the one that we've been noticing recently is the way those regional terms for people who are not like us, you know, uncultured people and uneducated people and, you know, rough people and the daggy people who live down the street, that we might have called Westies a while ago, and then in Tasmania we might have called Chiggers. In Queensland, we might have called Bevans. And in Canberra, we call Booners.
Bogan's got to get in there as well.
No, but the thing is that Bogan has taken over. Right? Sort of, you know, it's been the triumph of the Bogan. Well, they're everywhere.
See, I love my inner Bogan. I really do.
Yeah, there you go. but I mean, so when a word takes over Australia-wide like that, as Bogan has... and it only took it 20 years, you know, that those regional words are under threat. But your first question goes back to some of the issues that were raised this morning about the relationship between Aboriginal languages and Aboriginal Englishes and what's going on in Australian English. Because one of the fascinating things that we're noticing in producing a new edition of the Australian National Dictionary, when we look over the record of the last 20 years and look at the areas from which the greatest influx of words has come into Australian English in that period, they are words that are coming. They're not. A lot of them are, in fact, language words, right? So that if you look at Western Australia, there's been a policy of the Western Australian governments for the past 20 years to change names for flora and fauna from their English names back to their indigenous names. And it's a huge influx of terms of that kind in Western Australia. But as a result of Aboriginal cultural and political activism since the late 1960s, a whole number of terms to do with Aboriginal culture have come into Australian English. Even 10 years ago, I think most of us would think, you know, what's Kumanjaya when a word like that is used? But I think we now simply accept it and we understand how it's being used. What's interesting about the Northern Territory, though, is the fact that given its Aboriginal population, Aboriginal English has been much stronger, and we're not talking about Creole at this point, but Aboriginal English, as a variety, a dialect of Australian English, has been much stronger in the Northern Territory than in other parts of Australia. So words develop in Aboriginal English, and the one that was used, the first Australian word that was used today, which was the word deadly, is a word that's come into Australian English via Aboriginal English. And one suspects it probably started in the Northern Territory. I suspect a term such as shame job, right, which is a term from Aboriginal English, is one that spread from Aboriginal English into Australian English. Now, the word gammon that you mentioned there, is sort of meaning nonsense or something like that, is a word that if we were all sitting around, as David Malouf would like us to do, reading Dickens, we would come across gammon there, but it's a dead word. In standard English, almost a dead word, but it hung on from 19th century Pidgin English, it shifted across into 20th century Aboriginal Englishes. And what's happening in the Northern Territory, of course, is that it's now spread into the wider Australian English of the Northern Territory. So if you're reading the Northern Territory Times, it expects you know what gammon means, it expects you know what stop humbugging means. So that these are new areas of influxes of words into Australian English. And those influxes from Aboriginal culture and Aboriginal languages is simply one that one would not have predicted 50 years ago.
Ruby Langford is about to publish a book of blackfella humour called Only Gammon. That's coming out in the next few months. We'll finish with Julian's question.
Yeah, look, I'm at risk of bringing the tone down, I'm afraid, but I'm interested in slang, because, or rude words at least, because they tell us something about our appreciation of language, because words themselves are harmless, and the three words that get excised relate to things which are so familiar to all of us that it can hardly be the idea itself which is terrifying, or is it? I'm not sure. But I was wondering, I know that Qantas will remain in the dictionary, and hope it'll get a secondary definition, but I'm wondering, I've increasingly heard the word douche or douchebag used as an insult. I think it comes from South Park. Anyone who understands it's pretty offensively and probably should be ranked with the other three, shouldn't it?
I would have thought it's much older than South Park. It's been around for a long time as a term in American slang. I don't think we've got it in our dictionaries. It's probably just one of those ones that just sort of slipped away. but in a larger dictionary, obviously, it has to. It would be there. At the level of the larger dictionaries, I don't think one. I simply wouldn't be making judgments. Either about offensiveness or whatever, as long as they're labelled, as long as words are labelled appropriately. And I think this is one of the things that dictionaries are doing more and more these days, or it may be just things are changing. A good example is if you look at a dictionary from 30 years ago and look up nigger, it'll say, just the word to use at communion, or something like that. The dictionary just wasn't worried about it at all because the wider society wasn't. But I think dictionaries are much more careful these days to use that kind of labelling. So as long as the labelling is done, if something is offensive, you mark it as offensive, it'll be there.
All right, we better leave it there. Bruce Moore, thank you very much. Now we'll...
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.